Alrighty, and so we're at, with my great, great pleasure, I met this lovely woman a couple years ago at the Fourth Step Workshop, and my higher power picked this woman for me because I am not a calm person. Ever. Ask, do I ever even sleep, honey? I don't think I do. And I sat in my group, and it took me, the minute she looked at me, I just knew that my higher power had chosen her for me. And I needed a speaker, and I gave her a call, and it's with, and I'm so thankful that you said yes, and you're joining us here today. So it is with my great pleasure that I introduce our Al-Anon speaker this afternoon, Cindy S. from Bakersfield.
We did.
Okay, good.
We did.
Yeah. Thank you.
We had to have a height check earlier, not a sound check. So her husband brought me over here and said, could you stand here or could you can pull out this little lever and you can stand in front of it. So, but this is going to work for me. You guys can see me, right? I want to thank Tanya. When I met her 2 years ago at a four-step retreat, which I love the four-step retreat. If you haven't been there, make a point of going. And I was her leader. And normally I don't pick a prayer partner, but something about her just kind of called me. And so I said, you and I are going to be prayer partners. And then come to find out we had a lot in common, which is a good thing and a bad thing. So I want to thank my sponsor for being here, the women that hold me up for being here, and my sponsee for being here. I love you, Avoca. It takes a lot of courage to be here under you know, all the crises that we go through on a daily basis. I want to thank the committee because I know the work that goes into this. And we don't just show up and everything's done. You know, Tanya running to Chipotle to make sure the food's ready. And, you know, I don't know how she did it all by herself in those heels. My husband for bringing me up here and supporting me. And, you know, it's a miracle that we are still married today. I think we're going to celebrate 29 years in December. And thank you. That in itself is a miracle, to be honest with you, because of the disease of alcoholism. And my son, Timothy, you know, he called, or we've been trying to call each other before I spoke, and he wanted to give me some advice. So he said, Mom, don't let the truth get in front of a good story. So, and he's one of the alcoholics in my life. So go figure. Anyways, in AA as well, because of you, my husband and son can walk free today. Thank you very much. So I have cue cards only because I get stuck on words sometimes, and there's a reason why. So I'm not reading, I'm just cueing myself. So I'm going to talk about my relationships. First of all, I walked into Al-Anon October 2004. So this year would be my 11th year in Al-Anon. And I walked in because my son, the one that called me and gave me advice, had been missing for 4 days. So little did I know that I should have been there many, many years prior to this. But I do remember that in therapy years prior, my therapist said, you know who you should really try Al-Anon? And I thought, no, that's not how I deal with things. You know, I'm self-reliant, because the truth was, and I'll start with this, is my relationship with my mom. My mother is the alcoholic in my life, the very first one. I'm mother, daughter, niece, sister, wife of an alcoholic, and I love them all. I don't have them all in my life today, but I do love them. I'm the oldest daughter of three. My brother is 11 months older, older than me, but we were kind of like twins, and he kind of looked up to me, and, you know, he didn't mature as quick as I was maturing, and so he kind of followed me along, and I mothered him, and I tried to be what my mom couldn't be for him. Anyways, my mom used to love to drink. She had a big personality. Everybody wanted to be around her, and she was funny, and she was really funny. And she, you know, would play these little roles and make people laugh. And everybody used to say, "You have the best mom," and nobody knew what was going on inside those doors. The doors of our house, because when everyone's gone and the drinker or the alcoholic is still drinking, things happen, and those are really dark times for me. I used to isolate a lot because I didn't want to be part of the argument between her and my dad. My mom worked really hard, and however, she played really hard, and I think either. I'm not trying to exaggerate, I'm trying to get spot on with this, but I could say at least two times a week I would call, because she would let me know, call at this time, call my employer and tell them that my dad's sick and that I need to come home. Or that you're sick and I need to come home. And I can't remember how many times my grandfather died, but he did. And how many times we all had a cold, or you know the story. Anyways, so I would call and she would leave, and I knew not to expect her because she was going to go drinking with her buddies. And so she would call while she was out drinking, and she'd say, "Cindy, I'm going to walk you through dinner." And she would spend time walking me through what I was going to make for dinner. And she would stay out, and she said she would say, "Call me when your dad's getting home or coming home or when it's time," and I'd call her, and she'd leave there and drive drunk and come home and get. And the thing was this, and I just realized this just recently, is that she would walk in, and she would take credit for the whole thing. And one of my pet peeves, and I didn't realize why until recently, is that when people take credit for something that they didn't do, and that's what she did. She did that all the time. So here I was, she'd walk in, and I was getting that resentment. But the payoff for me is that she needed me. And so I continued to do it. I realized today that my mom was not mature. You know, she had a hard life herself. And she wasn't whole, and she really needed me and anyone else who was part of that whole situation to feel like a whole woman. She would say, "I'll pick you up from school," and usually an hour later she would come driving in with her buddies and pick me up, and they all thought, you know, laughing and lighthearted, and I was resentful and self-righteous. And I would say, you know, I knew that I was saying to myself, if I had a child, I wouldn't do this to them. So, I know what it did to me is that it really instilled a lot of fear and insecurities. And my first recollection of fear was when I was in my crib. And I don't know how long I stayed in my crib, but I can remember this. I can remember that I used to pull the covers over me, And I would stick my little fingers outside of the blanket so that if need be, my mom would know where I am. And I remember going to bed with that fear every night. And I can't remember not living with fear. And I think that everything was motivated by fear. At about 16, I started to realize that I was the mother in the house. And I was really sick and tired of being the good girl. I was tired of the straight A's. I was tired of doing all the work. And I started to rebel. I was tired of her not showing up for piano recitals. I was tired of her, I was just so sick and tired of her. And I was angry and resentful. And I started to think, maybe I should rebel, because when my brother's rebelling and he's getting all the attention, and so I did. And how I did it is I left. And I, decided that I didn't need them. But, and I left, I got married, I had a child, I was emancipated because of that. And I went to college and I took my baby with me. And what I could remember prior to, hold on, I gotta get this phone. Time. Okay, sorry about that. Anyways, I remember feeling like I could already have my own children and raise them, so I might as well have my own. And I really loved having my son, even at a very young age, because he needed me, and I needed people to need me so that I could feel better. And honestly, I could fall back into that any day, any time of the day. Even at this stage in my journey, I really, really like people to need me, and I have to look at that. And in that, I had to look at that recently and make sure that my commitments were not too much, because I love service, and I love to be needed. I like the purpose. Anyways, if you're an adult child of an alcoholic, you know what I'm talking about when I say this, but in from Survival to Recovery, it has this perfect page that reads, it's page 20, and it said, it explains it like this. This is how it was. It was fear. Fear of rejection, fear of the unknown, fear of being known, a constant, nagging fear that never goes away. And that's how it felt. And in my adolescence, I was so afraid that, I decided, staying there was not healthy, because the violence kind of started. Now, I knew that some things would happen. I'd hear my parents laughing in their room, and all of a sudden there'd be a thump, and then there'd be the cries. So I knew that there was something happening, and I didn't want to be a part of it. So anyways, and it was lonely. It was so desperately wanting to be a part of something and pushing you so far away that you couldn't possibly connect with me. And that's what I did. By running away, I didn't want to be connected to any person, because I didn't just run away. I left Bakersfield completely. And I went up north to Napa Valley and lived with my aunt until I could get my own place. So that's my behavior. I'll run away and not have a relationship, and I don't have to do that today in this program. Even if, I would kind of like look for people who made me feel comfortable, and those are usually the sick ones. Prior to running away, I did, like I said, have this baby and get married to this guy, and he wasn't a good guy. He wasn't faithful. He was an alcoholic. And I remember taking him back, because he gave that promise, I'll never do this again, I'll never do this again. And I just wanted to be needed, and I thought I could help him, kind of clean up. And that just never happened. So it was very confusing, and confusing is part of what my story is. I love to be confused because I don't have responsibility. I love staying confused. Today I don't love doing that because then I can't live my life. But I used to love being confused. I remember my sponsor and I would did a lot of phone calls because we lived 2 hours away from each other. And when I would get off the phone with her and she'd have all these assignments for me, I would stay confused. And then I would be confused for like 2 days, and then I'd call her back and I would say, What did you say? Because I had no idea. Was that so? It felt like I was traveling like 5 seconds behind my own body. And when I would catch up, I needed to repeat what I would just be so lost. And that's why confusion really, really did work for me. But it hurt me. It made me feel like there was something wrong with me. And I was told that I overreacted or that I was too sensitive. And I learned not to trust my own self. I learned not to trust that inner voice in my inside of me and in my heart. And I learned not to trust God. And somewhere down the road, I just got disconnected. And I was trying to connect, but it just never happened. So that little light inside of me, or that voice, was just, you know, gradually going dimmer and dimmer. And another thing that I did is I was needy. In that same page, it says that we don't want the people that say they love you to go away, but when they go away, we're afraid they'll come back. And that's how I felt. When my mom, when I decided to move out of town and my mom kind of packed me up and said, sure, I'll get you away from this loser, she said, Cindy, never come back. We don't want you to come back to Bakersfield. And it was devastating because I think I was about 18 years old, and I still needed a mom that I never had. I was a motherless adult child, motherless woman. And you know, I'll talk about that later on, because I am no longer that person. I needed to be treated special in order to feel normal. And I looked for people that treated me special. I looked for people that made me feel like I was enough, and it was usually people who needed something from me. And it was also about trust, being told that I didn't see what I saw. And I hate that today. I live in the present, and I really focus on what's happening, and when I get told that I didn't see what I saw, you know, I have to really check my attitude about that, because I really have an issue with that. It's never being able to trust, because my whole life is based on pretense, and that's how it was. I was in denial, and I don't know that I was just in denial, because honestly, I was disillusioned, because I believed exactly what my head told me. So that was my relationship with my parents and what happened to me. My mom ended up dying in May 2004, and she had cancer. And I remember the oncologist telling her, Sally, you know, you need to stop drinking, because it raises the level of risk to getting cancer by 40%. And so, but did she stop? She didn't stop. So she died in her disease. I remember going to the hospital, and I took some time off to help her. She didn't want anybody to help her bathe her. She wanted me to do it, and I felt really imprisoned by that. I felt like I was stuck, and I needed to do this thing because it was my obligation to once again raise my mom. She used to tell people, Cindy, raise me. And I remember resenting that because I wanted a mother. So prior to her dying, I had to, you know, she was very insecure in that hospital, and she would say, please get Cindy, please get Cindy. And I remember one day showing up with her breakfast, because she didn't like hospital food, and she said, Cindy, you turned out to be such a good woman despite of everything I did to you. And I really do feel like that was her way of making amends to me. I feel that though I didn't see it at the time, that she was saying, yes, I know you were no longer invisible. I remember what happened. And that was so important to me. And I'm sure that that was God working in my life. So I also have a brother who's alcoholic and insecure and kind of stuck to me like a security blanket. And my younger sister is 7 years younger than me. And there was a lot of separation between her and I. And there still kind of is. There's still issues that we need to really work out. Though I love her so much, there are still things that need to happen. She says, you know, she'll call and she'll always say, well, how is AA doing? And I remind her that I'm not an alcoholic, that I go to Al-Anon. Okay, so you have to know something about my sister. She's a licensed clinical social worker. And she still asks me how AA's doing. And so she's still out of touch with that. And, you know, and I want to sit her down and tell her what's what, but I just don't because well, it's kind of funny. It, you know, I could use that. I could use a good laugh sometimes. And then the other alcoholic in my life is my husband. And like I said, I was married to he's my second husband. I was married to an alcoholic. And, you know, funny thing with him, he was so unfaithful. I think James and I were already married, and he died. He was actually murdered by his girlfriend, because he was walking in an alley with another woman. And she just ran that car into him, and he went flying and busted his neck as he hit the tree. And so, but the thing is that I had his son. And Danny's alcoholic as well. And I'll talk about that. And it's very interesting. In the 10 years that I, or in the last 11 years that I've been in program, I have seen him one time. And I raised his son because he got pregnant before he didn't get pregnant, but his girlfriend did. Well, my babysitter got pregnant. And, you know, he was on the rebound, and one day I was gone, and the next day I'm my grandmother, and this, no one can raise this little boy. So Danny quit coming around because there's some really terrible things that happened with Anthony. I actually inherited him through Child Protective Services. He was badly beaten and black-eyed and broken legs, and I had been in a really bad accident, and my son Danny used to work for IKEA, and he would travel throughout California and set up IKEAs. And so he was in town one day, October 31st, and I said, I could only write what I wanted, and I wrote, can you please go check on Anthony? So he went to go check on Anthony at this house, and where his wife or his ex lived, and the boyfriend, and he knocked on the door, and the door just kind of flung open, and Anthony might have been 2 years old about that time, and he came crawling out with a broken leg and a dirty diaper. And Danny didn't even enter the door, he just grabbed Anthony, and he called me on the way, and he says, Mom, he's really, really hurt. And of course, I couldn't talk, so James talked to him and said, we'll meet you at KMC, and that's the closest hospital to where we lived. I actually sponsor an attorney who for Child Protective Services, and she and this other lady were in that courtroom when we got custody, and she said, Cindy, we never have that, it's very few people have that much evidence, and Anthony's body had a lot of evidence of abuse. So, well, I raised that little boy, and I know that Danny felt very guilty about everything, and he kind of just said, you guys can do better than I can. So he kind of checked out, and every so often he calls. And you know how God is? God is so good to me, because sometimes it really hurts. Most days I can do this, but some days it really, really hurts. It hurts because I've not been part of his life for 10 years. I saw him one time. He was really skittish and real squirrely, but he met us at breakfast, and I made my amends with him, and James made his amends, and it was a really close moment, and he said, "Mom, I'm going to be part of Anthony and yours life." And I said, "Why don't you just start with me? If you can be part of my life and be consistent, because and then maybe you can have life with Anthony," because he would come in and out, and so would his mother. And his mother was, the only time she was sober was when she was pregnant, and she had about, I don't know, 6 kids. And so Anthony has 6 other siblings, and we raised him, and it was our privilege. When we took on Anthony, I just said, "We're going to do this." And I had no idea what For Fun and For Free was, but that was my attitude, because I wasn't going to just let him go into some system where, you know, I actually wanted to adopt. I wanted to foster. And James was completely against that, because he works in the mental health field, and you see a lot of situations that are really hard to deal with in fostering, and he didn't want to do it, but I did. And then here comes Anthony, and so Anthony was my gift. That was the little boy that I could raise and love just like my own. And today he's 19 years old, and he's just a wonderful kid. Not without his own Alateen stuff, but he's a wonderful kid, not perfect. Anyways, just to move on about Danny. Like I said, sometimes it really, really hurts. It's really interesting because I pray for Danny twice a day. I just make it a point, a deliberate point, to pray for him in the morning and to pray for him at night, because he needs our prayer. And anytime I really, you know, come to a meeting, and the girls don't usually see me cry very much, but when I come into a meeting and all I could do is say, "Pass," because it hurts so much that day, something happens, and it's usually around an AA member that I get to know that he's okay. First one was this kid that got sober with my youngest son, Justin Brown, and sorry about that, I guess I shouldn't say his name, but anyways, you don't know. Danny called and he said, "Mom, there's a guy here that I'm working with, and he says you're his mom." And I said, "Well, who is that?" He goes, "I'll put him on." And it was Justin, and he called me Mom, because he got sober with Timothy, but he went back out. And then he's connected to Danny, and you know, I pray that God puts AA people in his way all the time. And then it was some guy who played pool, which my husband knew from San Diego in the program, and that guy saw James and said, "Hey, your kid's alive, and he really misses you guys." And, you know, James says, "Well, he knows our number." And then here recently, we find out that Danny calls and he says, "Mom, how do you know my papa," that's what he calls him, "his girlfriend's grandfather?" And I said, "Well, who is that?" And Jim. "Well, Jim goes to AA. He's my buddy. He's my husband's buddy. And he's dating their granddaughter." And a couple of, well, maybe about 4 weeks ago, my husband went on a fishing trip that he goes to usually every year. And it's an AA fishing trip. And Jim was there, and he told James, at least this is the story I got from James, that he said, "The next time Danny comes to town, I'm going to tell him that he needs to make this good with you guys." And James said to him, "Don't. Next time you see Danny, you tell him we love him." And so we don't need any other person telling Danny what to do. We could do that, but we know it's not. He's going to do it when he wants to. So anyways, that's my story about Danny, and it's I don't know why I don't usually talk about it, but I needed to talk about it today because it's something that I want to not keep in my head. I need you guys to know about this information with me. And he's not sober. He's a farmer. So he says, for the federal government, he farms marijuana. And I don't even know if it's true. It just seems so far-fetched. But he's really proud of it. In fact, he sends me pictures. He sends me pictures of the, you know, his land, and he's got about 10 acres, and he sends me, like, there's little pot trees everywhere, and his house, and his dog, and he fishes all the time, and he's got this beautiful dog and his rifle. I don't know why you need a rifle when you're farming, but, you know, whatever. So, you know, I get to know these, and most of the time, Al-Anon has given me the tools to know that I don't have to go in this alone, and so I don't. And so I started going to Al-Anon, not because of the alcoholics I just spoke to you about. I started going to Al-Anon because of my son, Timothy. And Timothy was 16 years old at the time, and he was missing for 4 days. And I started to notice that a lot of our liquor was missing, but, you know, I'm so in denial with the whole thing. Like I said, I'm like 5 seconds behind my body, and if my body hits a point that I don't want anything to do with, I just kind of direct myself in a different way. And that's how I live my life. Never being in that present. So there was a lot of liquor missing. I didn't care. There was also a lot of drugs missing because I have lupus. Doctors always want to give me these, you know, Norco, Vicodin. Well, I don't like taking them. It doesn't work for me. It makes me, I don't want to be sleepy. I don't want to not know what's going on. That does not work for me. I want to know what's going on so that I can manage it into unmanageability. So anyway, so here's Timothy, and he's 16 years old, and he's been gone. A lot of vodka's gone from our house. There's a lot of water bottles in his bedroom that smell like vodka. You know, I didn't have a clue. But my nephew said, I don't know at what point, I guess one of the first days when he was missing, he said, and I know this is AA, but this is just part of his story. He said, Aunt Cindy, I think he is doing meth too. And I'm in the medical field. I had never even heard of meth. I didn't understand. I mean, I've heard of speed, and I've heard of, cocaine. I've had friends who did cocaine. I never did it. I'm the one that was a driver. That stuff didn't work for me. I mean, like, how could you lose that much control of yourself? It's embarrassing. That's how I felt. This whole meth thing in Bakersfield, I mean, it was never on the news, but about 2 months prior to that point, Timothy went missing. And what happened was that that story kind of came to my head, and the story was like this. This gal, the single mother, was missing. She was in her early 20s, and what they found, a video of her being chopped up into little pieces by her cousins that were on meth. So, and that she was put in a barrel, and 4 days later she was found. And I'm sure, Olga, you remember your... And that's the first time I've ever heard of meth at all. And so in my head, every single night, I lay in bed, just paralyzed with fear, thinking that Timothy was chopped up into little pieces and stuck in a barrel in someone's garage. Because that's the only association I had with it. And it's not that I thought, good morning, Cindy, today we're going to be delusional. I was delusional. I really believed those things. It's not something that I tried to do, and it's not something, my head never tells me to go get better. My head tells me to get worse. Or just, no, try harder, is what my head says. We walked into the meeting, and I bought a book. It was How Al-Anon Works. It's in the car. I still have it today, and I don't know that sometimes I can read the words that are on that page, but I just write all over it. And there's a chapter, the very first chapter, it's the many faces of Al-Anon, and it's great to read that because you can identify. But there's different things like lost, confused, and happy, ungrateful, resentful, self-righteous, self-pitied, and humiliated. But those are like, there's about 3 or 4 pages of different people saying how they feel. And the cruel joke with this is that I related to all of them. So what was wrong with me? I mean, it may be one or two, but I was all of it. So, identified right away. And I was so desperate at the time. So that if you told me to stand in the corner and pick my nose and your son would get better, I would have done that. Because I was just really desperate. I think that's a great thing, to be desperate when you walk in, because that motivated me to do something about it. It's like when Timothy started using, it felt like there was a big mountain and all the stuff that happened throughout my childhood just hit me in the back. And I wasn't just feeling Timothy, I was feeling every alcoholic in my life. And I was feeling all the guilt and shame, because when you guys act out, honestly, and it talks about this in how Al-Anon works, that I secretly blame myself. And I did. Everything that you guys, the alcoholics did, I blame myself. I was ashamed, and I was, and here was this kid who we loved, and he was a kind of a blessing in our life, because I could only have one more pregnancy, and that was going to be it. And the minute he came out, he was like the king of the house, and we did everything for him. And we loved him, and we thought that if we loved him really, really hard, that he would be okay. And this is James and I. And James grew up in alcoholism, and so did I. So we were like a train wreck. And the result was Tim. And he was part of that speeding train. And by the time we got into the program and we finally found him, I didn't find him. My son, Danny, did. He dragged him out of a drug house and brought him over to our house and just dropped him off. And that kid in, 30 minutes completely tore up the house. He was just so out of it. And I do believe that he was mentally ill at the time. Not today. He knows what he's doing today. But Tim said that... That he didn't recognize the person that he would see, and he hadn't laughed for many years. And we had a service go look for him, pick him up, and take him to a rehab. And 3 days later, he was the kid who was homicidal and suicidal, because I got to tell you, it was getting so bad that I felt like I had to say goodbye. And one morning about 4 a.m., he comes walking in the door. And I could hear the door slam, and James and I still slept with our lights on because we wanted to, be awake when that kid walked in, because he was missing so much and living in bushes and being gone so much. Anyways, he walked in, and I thought to myself, I need to tell him bye. And he was so out of it. I kissed his cheek, and I said bye, and I walked away, and I went into my room, and I didn't know if I'd ever see him again. But we did. But this is how sick I got. I thought that my head was so crazy at the time that I thought that, because I felt like he was in the neighborhood, and honestly, sometimes I see him walking around like a zombie, and I would just keep on going, because I knew that if I stopped, this kid would spit on me or something. He was just so angry. In my head, I thought, what motherly thing could I do to save my son? And that's what my thought was. Like, what can I possibly do to save this kid? Okay, Cindy, if you bake, he'll come home. That's how crazy I got. If you'll bake, he'll come home. And but he likes muffins, he likes biscuits. Yeah, that day, okay, today I'm going to make biscuits. And maybe as he walks by, he'll smell the biscuits and come home. And then I'd say, the biscuits didn't work, so I'll make cookies. And that's how crazy I got. I thought that somehow he was going to smell it, and then he was going to come home. And, I was fresh out of ideas. And I was going to meetings, I wasn't talking, I was crying, and I think I cried for about 3 months, and they just let me. They just didn't say anything to me, they just let me. And they, after the meetings, they told me funny stories about their children. There wasn't a lot of parents in the meetings in Bakersfield when I walked in. There was one older couple in there, and their son was like 50 years old, and he was living in a car, and that's it. But there's this one lady who would come up to me continually and just say, honey, it's going to be okay, it's going to be okay. And that was Pat Cantrell. And she, I don't know, has like 50 years in the program or something before. And, you know, she was definitely sent to me by my higher power. And to this day, she's in my life. Anyway, she always said it was going to get better. Timothy being homicidal and suicidal, like I said, we sent him off, and then he came back 30 days after the program. He came back with this chip, and it said 30 days, and he said he didn't earn it, some other guy earned it, and he gave it to him and said, I hope you can earn this one day. And still to this day, he gives away his chips to a newcomer, and he'd say, I hope that you can earn this one day, because he was taught that. And so James, while all this was happening, was really checked out. And I just, you know, I wanted him to do something, and I would probe him, you know, maybe if I yell at him. Oh, and I started cussing at the time, because I thought if I cuss, they'd really know that I meant business. And, you know, I'm 4'11". If I cuss, it's not going to make a difference. It really isn't. People are still going to say, aw, that's cute. And so I couldn't figure out why James was so checked out. And it was Christmas Eve and at my brother's house, and my whole family was there, but Timothy wasn't. And nobody asked me where Timothy was. They didn't want to know. They're all alcoholic themselves. And I watched my husband get drunk, and I looked at him, and I had the realization that James might be alcoholic. And I said, I want to go home. And in Bakersfield, if you've never been there in the fog, it's really, really thick. And you can't see past your car. And he was drunk, it was foggy, and I let him drive me home, and I had this idea, like, I started to realize that I'm sitting in the car, because like my body finally, I caught up to my body, and I said, I'm presently in this car with this alcoholic in this fog, and I'm having him drive me home. There is something wrong with me. And I asked him why he couldn't stop drinking while his son was dying. And that was the last day he took a drink and went to AA himself. My mom had died, like I said, 6 months prior to going into the program. And Timothy was so affected by that because she was his first drinking buddy. And you know, my mom was all about laughs, giggles, and fun. And like I said, she just didn't have the maturity to raise us. So I became aware of how deeply I was affected by this disease, and it had nothing to do with Timothy. In fact, I think I affected him very much. The issue was that somehow, at least what you were telling me, is that somehow I'm spiritually sick, and I believed that. And so I started to really look at that. And the program also says get a sponsor and do the steps, and I wouldn't do that right away. And I just, you know, 8 months into it, and I was sitting there wringing my hands, and that 16-year-old boy who's in AA said, Mom, you know what you're doing? I said, what? He said, you're sitting there worrying, telling God that you don't have any faith in him. God forbid you get a sponsor and do the work. And that kind of pissed me off, because I didn't want the 16-year-old kid to tell me what to do. And that made me mad enough to go get a sponsor. And that one didn't stick, but quickly after that, I got a sponsor, and she's been my sponsor. And I'm so glad that you're here and that your family has supported us. It's just not Betty Ann, but it's also Bob. I just have to say that. Sometimes I would call and Betty Ann wouldn't be around, and Bob would say, well, what's going on? And I would tell him. And he'd just say, you can't force the alcoholic to do anything, you know that. And I started to realize what powerless was. I mean, I remember the moment that I surrendered to God, and that was one night when Timothy came home and he told me that he was going to murder me, and this is how he was going to do it. And he said, I won't even let you die quickly. I would like to torture, he said something about torturing me, and that's all I heard. And I thought, like, it was like I was floating in a cloud, and I was walking down the hallway. And as I walked down the hallway, I picked up my grandson, and I put him in my room. And I don't even know when James, joined me, but I barricaded the door and locked it. And I remember feeling like God had forgotten about us somehow, or I did something wrong, and this is just how it was going to be. And I remember getting on my knees and just saying that one prayer that says, you know, I don't really know if you're out there, but if you are, we could use some help. And then I got into bed, and at this point, I didn't really care who died. Honestly, I just had lost all hope. And I didn't hear anything, but I smelled smoke, and Timothy had lit his bedroom on fire. I remember thinking to myself, I don't care. I didn't care who died that night. Thankfully, the fire went out, whether he did it or not, didn't know. I heard the door slam. The next morning, we saw the big black mark on his carpet that he had burned, and his cell phone was smashed up in the front yard. So, you know, we lost him one more time. But, you know, and I get asked a lot, and I was talking to my sponsor about this. I get asked a lot about this. You know, Timothy's sober now, and he's got 10 years in the program, and I'm way out here. I'm so grateful for that miracle. But I get asked why Timothy got sober, why my prayers aren't, I get asked by moms, why is my prayer not working? And what she taught me was that that Timothy was willing to surrender. And not everybody's willing to surrender. We have a parent meeting now, parent focus meeting, that Olga and I started. And the pain that happens in that room, because it's okay. So with my husband, I can really do the detachment. I didn't even think he was alcoholic at first. I just thought he was weird, and because he didn't drink like my family did. My family drank and they got angry. James didn't get angry. He got loving. He cleaned the house. He'd barbecue. No, I didn't want that to stop. It was really helpful, and it was working for me. So oh my goodness. Sometimes the house is dirty, and it still crosses my mind. The kids are all gone, and the house rarely gets dirty. It's amazing. Get rid of the kids. That's my message. Anyways, that burning room. I know that our literature says that we have to surrender, and we have to surrender this, that I am completely powerless over an alcoholic or alcohol in general, and that I have to see the disease for myself and how I was affected. And I knew that he needed help, and I couldn't give it to him. So, you know, after the 30-day stay in rehab, he came back home. He didn't. He looked like he was going to use, and so I sent him back again. Anyways, I really need to move forward, and I'll have to tell you with my husband. Timothy's in the program. He's doing good, and I'm in the program. I have my sponsor. James is in the program, and he's stuck. And he has a sponsor that he doesn't really call, and something's happening to him, and he's closing down. And You know, I really wasn't upset with my son. I really wasn't upset with my husband, but everything that my mom and dad did was kind of like presenting itself in my husband. And even while I was kind of going back and looking at my journals and literature and to see what I had written, I kind of got angry this week. And I wasn't mad at James, but I just wanted to kill him because of everything that happened. But the truth is, I have the kindest husband. He is the kindest man, and he's always of service to me. And today I can count on him. We've worked a lot, worked on our trust issues, and we still have a ways to go, but we're on the right track. Like I said, being married for 29 years in the disease, it's a miracle, and I'm grateful for that. I learned to surrender in my steps. I know that our 12 steps teach us how to love ourselves, and the traditions teach us how to love others, and our concepts teach us how to love the world, and that's what it says and how Al-Anon works. And becoming aware of my part in things, you know, I thought that was going to be a punishment because that's all I knew. But that's not what happened. I got freedom by telling my sponsor what all my deepest, darkest secrets. And sometimes I don't know my deepest, darkest secret until it happens. You know, my memory brings it back, and I have to call her, and I have to say, you know what, this happened. It was so strange, and this is how I feel about it. Because I'm not done yet. We're in recovery. And so getting back to how I wanted to kill James today, or this week, you know, for a second, he knew I was upset about something, and, you know, I started, you know, attaching those buttons that you could push because I was looking at my alcoholism in my family. And so we get mad at each other, and then we laugh, and then we forgive each other. And that's recovery to me, when I can be aware of what I'm doing, and I've learned to love myself, and I can let it go. And sometimes that takes 2 minutes, and sometimes it takes an hour. It just depends on how stubborn I am at that day, at that point. And so with the 12 steps, I learned that surrender was a process, and it's in degrees. I had these degrees of surrender, and today people can tell me what to do, and I don't get offended that you think I don't know what I'm doing. And today I don't feel less than or uncomfortable with my recovery. I don't feel like God just dropped me off anymore. And every morning I turn my life and my will over to the care of God. And, you know, I wanted to really be prepared for this. And all week long, in fact, this whole entire month has been filled up with other people. And I realized this week that that is my recovery. That I relive recovery when my sponsees come over and they sit at my table and we do the steps. And nothing could ever take that away from me. I have that voice that went dim as an adult child way back in my 20s. Today, in my 50s, it's loud and clear, but not every day. Sometimes it's harder, it comes harder, but some days it's easy. And I learned early on to really read my literature and how Al-Anon works, which I love that book. It says that shifting my focus, I'm gonna botch it up because I'm not gonna read it, I don't have the book. That I will be able to see that in every person, the disease of alcoholism, there's a part of every person that hasn't been touched by the disease. And initially I felt that I was doing this all for them, but honestly that statement said something to me. It said that there's a part of me that hasn't been touched by the disease. And that's the part that I hold on to every day. That's the part that I nurture every day. in recovery, I learned to take risks. And there were so many things that I wanted to do. And I was angry with my mom for not realizing what kind of kid she had, because I thought a lot of myself. And I was angry that she didn't, you know, understand that I loved art. I was angry that she didn't, when they went to buy me a piano, they stopped at a bar and never came back with it. I was angry that she just didn't realize, like what I said, who I was. Because I felt like I had a lot to give. And again, I was just wanting people to need me. But the reality of that is that I thought about that. Everything that I think my mom should have nourished in me, I'm already that person. That happened in these rooms. I had the women, one on my right, one on my left, and my sponsor in front of me, and my sponsors behind me. They held me up, and they helped me grow up and be this woman. My mom did a lot of wonderful things, and she's a big part of my story. And today I can say that she was pretty amazing. And I don't have to be resentful at her anymore. I don't have to be sarcastic anymore about what she did. And so in closing, I'd just like to say that that I'm not special, that I wasn't treated more lovingly than anyone else was treated in the rooms. I just showed up, and I got my recovery an hour and a half at a time at every meeting I went to, every phone call I made, and now I have 11 years of an hour and a half at a time. And my life is wonderful, and I owe that all to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Cindy. I'd like to give Cindy another round of applause, please.